You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. In nature, it has been said, life always finds a way. That's the idea, anyhow. You might remember Jeff Goldblum's character articulating this truth in the movie Jurassic Park.
Listen, if there's one thing the history of evolution has taught us, it's that life will not be contained. Life breaks free, it expands to new territories, and it crashes through barriers painfully, maybe even dangerously, but, well, there it is.
There it is.
You're implying that a group composed entirely of female animals will breed?
No, I'm simply saying that life finds a way.
Life finds a way. Goldblum's character was, of course, referring to dinosaurs, fictitious dinosaurs at that. But long before the Jurassic Age, plants had to find their way in the Cambrian period. And thanks to the process of photosynthesis, they did, giving way to dinosaurs and eventually animal life as we know it today. But what if, in some ways, nature isn't necessarily good at finding its way, or at least not as good as we tend to think and as we might need it to be? A recent piece in The New Yorker called Creating a Better Leaf highlights an Illinois-based research project that argues, as remarkable as photosynthesis is, it needs to do better. And if science can find a way to help nature find a better way by tinkering with photosynthesis and making it more efficient, there is a promise that it can help address the world's food crisis. The research project called RIPE, that's for Realizing Increased Photosynthetic Efficiency, it was launched in 2012 with a $25 million grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Professor Stephen Long is the director of RIPE. He's also the Eikenberry Endowed University Chair of Crop Sciences and Plant Biology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He joins us now. Stephen, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation at 800-222-9455. Maybe we have some farmers listening who might have questions about what more efficient photosynthesis might mean for them in the future for crop yields, food production. 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21st Show. So I want to begin with taking a step back, and maybe you can just sort of give us a brief photosynthesis 101 refresher. I think it's probably been since seventh grade or high school, since a lot of us have thought too much about photosynthesis. How does it work, and what does it mean for life on Earth?
Okay, well, first of all of our food, directly or indirectly, comes from the process of photosynthesis. And everything we see around us, essentially the natural world, it's all driven by photosynthesis. So you could argue it's the most important process on the planet. And of course, it's where the oxygen has come from in the atmosphere as well, where all of our fuels, directly or indirectly, apart from nuclear, come from too, and wind. So simply the process is using light energy to reduce carbon dioxide to carbohydrates, which can then be used in the synthesis of all of the chemicals which make up a plant and which we consume.
One of the things that is so interesting as I was reading about your project and photosynthesis is that it's a process that is not all that different today from how it began. Maybe it's not correct to say it's sort of not not subject as much to natural selection as we might have thought. I don't know if you can explain why photosynthesis is inefficient as you're positing.
Yeah, it's correct that the basic process has really changed very little with time. And of course, to some extent, that would have an evolutionary basis. Yeah. It's absolutely essential for a plant. So if evolution tinkers with that, the risk is that the organism will never survive. It is very conserved, but we have shown, going through all of the theory of the steps, that the efficiency of actually even our best crops today falls so far below the theoretical. Now, in evolution, I mean, it's about a gene getting itself into the next generation and multiplying. as we see with coronavirus. So,
indeed.
So organisms don't have to be or genes don't have to have a productive carrier to move on to the next generation. So evolution is not really about productivity.
Maybe another way to say it is, I mean, survival of the fittest, right? It's survival. It's not maximization.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the premise, I understand, of ripening, I should add, we need to take a break in a little less than 2 minutes here, but is the idea that photosynthesis needs to do better. So what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, we started off by Illinois has always been a world center for the study of the process of photosynthesis. Many of the discoveries around how photosynthesis works were made here. So we then took that in 2000, we took that to a new level. And that was now, with all that knowledge, to simulate the whole process on our supercomputers. Then we could start to optimize those, if you like, in silico, to then see, well, where are the pressure points? Where might we intervene? And that is really what the RIPE project is about. We've now, that funding has given us the chance to, okay, test out what the models were telling us.
Fascinating,
and
yeah.
That has been with some successes.
And certainly Urbana, Champaign seems to be a uniquely situated place for both crop study and computer science and bringing those together. We're going to talk a little bit more about that and what the RIPE project is working on. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Long from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. As I mentioned earlier, he's the head of RIPE, which is Realizing Increased Photosynthetic Efficiency, basically working to find a way to make plants do a better job at converting the sun's light into energy. And the ultimate aim is to help address the world's food crisis without exacerbating our climate problems. More to come in this conversation after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Long from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who's the director of a project aimed at increasing the efficiency of photosynthesis, basically making plants better at converting the sun's light into energy in our food supply. The idea is the world is facing a hunger crisis, potentially, in the years ahead, and also a climate crisis. How do you solve one without exacerbating the other? More efficient plants without necessarily taking up more space for farmland, but creating more energy for us to consume through our food is the answer. So before the break, we were talking about computer modeling and how that was sort of helped some of the breakthroughs here. I understand early on you had to solicit help from a NASA rocket scientist. Can you talk about what happened as you were developing these models?
Sure. the models we were developing are, you know, what are called a system of differential equations, which require numerical integration. So that's very
calculus,
computationally,
basically, right?
Yes, intensive. And when we eventually got our system built, we then found that as we tried to run the model, it failed a number of times. And we were actually at the National Center for Supercomputer Applications, and we were talking about the problems we were having. And a member of the computer science department, who was funded by NASA, said, "Oh, I had exactly the same problem with trying to balance rocket motors, and here's how I solved it." And so we used his method, and it worked for us. So we could say that photosynthesis is rocket science, although in fact our colleague actually said, "Your system is much more complex than mine," which gained his interest in it.
That's amazing. People always talk about the sort of knock-on effects of space research and NASA science. Here's another one, potentially, I guess. So as you're developing these, you know, as what are you learning from the computer models that are, you know, and how do you implement that in an actual field?
Yes, from the computer models, we could see two things. If you think of photosynthesis, you know, from light and carbon dioxide in to carbohydrate out, it's very much like a production line. So, you know, if you think of a car production line, what we were trying to do was say, well, we've got 1,000 workers, you know, what is the bottleneck on there? Is it, for example, making seats? So we need to move people around. And that's exactly what we tried to do in photosynthesis, to say, okay, where should resource be placed to get more out without needing to put more in? And so we could then identify some of these bottlenecks. The other thing we could do with the models is say, well, plants don't have this particular pathway, but algae or bacteria do. What would happen if we put that in? And so we've been using both of those approaches. We could then identify genes that we might put into the plant, or genes in the plant that we would try and upregulate so they make more of that protein, which is a bottleneck. And those are the approaches that we've now been able to put into practice.
What does this look like in the field if it's as successful as you hope it might be, right? Are we talking about corn stalks 12 feet tall with cobs as big as my forearm, or what are we looking at?
Well, we haven't got to corn with this yet.
Okay.
It'll sound odd, but in fact, we start off with tobacco. The reason we do that is it's very easy to genetically change tobacco, and it produces a large amount of seed. So within 12 months, we can go from our genetic manipulation to a replicated field trial.
It's like the fruit flies or the lab rats of agriculture research.
Yes, yeah. And if that works, then we know it's worth taking it to our food crops, which take longer to genetically change and test. And of course, that all is more expense. So we want to be sure that what we've got is really worth progressing along there. So with that approach, we've now shown in tobacco three quite different manipulations, which give us about a 20% increase in productivity in the field. Two of those we've now taken to an initial field trial, one with soybean, one with potatoes, where we've also seen a similar improvement. The exciting thing with the soybean trial was that not only did we get significantly more seed, but that seed maintained its protein and oil content. So that was telling us that clearly the plant must be using some of this increased photosynthesis to feed the rhizobia that are producing the nitrogen, because if that didn't happen, we would have seen a drop in protein. So that's very promising. A member of our team in Australia is now trying to put this into cowpea, which is the major vegetable protein source in West Africa as well. It's, if you like, sometimes referred to as the poor man's meat. And so that scientist in Australia has very strong links with breeders in Nigeria. So we see that as one route for our technologies to start to move to sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because obviously this is one of the aims here is addressing hunger and, you know, potential food crisis. And, a couple of generations ago, I guess, you know, there were books, The Population Bomb is one. There were others predicting sort of mass catastrophe for humanity and mass starvation. And agriculture stepped up, and there was a revolution in that. And some say we're in need of another one now. And yet, Africa and Europe as well, the people are very skeptical of these of genetically modified plants. Is that, how do you work to overcome that? Or do I misunderstand something about what you're doing and what they're afraid of?
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly the case. I mean, our skill set is in really providing a technology that could be used by breeders. You know, I wouldn't pretend that we're the people who can take this to African farmers. That, and indeed, this is something that the Gates Foundation is very involved in. You know, has even built a new organization that can take technologies like us and can deal with all of those downstream issues. But there is skepticism. However, our colleague in Australia has been working with the Nigerian government for 20 years and is very tied in with breeders in Nigeria, has many colleagues there, where he's been trying to take BT, you know, which of course we use in almost all of our corn crop here to defend against insect damage. He's been trying to put that, he's put that into cowpea and then work with the Nigerian government on testing it, you know, using Western methods of testing transgenic crops. And 2 years ago, that was officially deregulated by the Nigerian government. And so the breeders he's worked with have now got this into seed systems, and it's been in huge demand among growers in Nigeria, because, you know, the insect damage to the cowpea crop can be huge. It can completely wipe out a smallholder's crop. So there are breakthroughs beginning to occur in that. Subsequent to that, then the Nigerian government deregulated BT corn as well. That has been deregulated in South Africa for some time. And BT cotton has been deregulated, of course, in many African countries, but it isn't a food crop. But generally, farmers have been very enthusiastic to get hold of that because it gives them much more security on their crop.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Long from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who's the director of a project called Realizing Increased Photosynthetic Efficiency, or RIPE, which is celebrating 10 years this year. It got started a decade ago with a support from the Gates Foundation, and it was featured in the New Yorker recently in an article called Making a Better Plant. 800-222-9455 if you have a question in our last 5 minutes or so on air today. 800-222-9455. I think it would be fair to say that attempts to control nature, there are often unintended consequences, not necessarily bad consequences, but I wonder, what are you keeping an eye on in terms of, you know, risks and or maybe obstacles and challenges to this research?
Well, obviously, one of the major things, you know, we have to look at with transgenic crops is, you know, escape of the transgene. So, clearly, with the crops like soybean and cowpea, they are inbreeding, i.e., they pollinate themselves. So these have a much lower risk. We're also looking at cassava, which is actually propagated, cloned, if you like. So what the farmer is planting is not seed, it is a root, so that, again, that, you know, hugely cuts the risk of the transgene moving into non-transgenic crops. Maize, of course, is a whole different story. But of course, it's something that, you know, given its very wide use of transgenic maize in the Americas, you know, we clearly have a handle on controlling that. But that is obviously the number one risk. The other thing that has come out of the RIPE project is some of the manipulations we've made have shown that it could be worth trying to do this by conventional breeding. And that is some of, not all of the things we're doing, but some of the things where we're upregulating genes the plant already has. we've now gone back to looking at, well, maybe there's natural variation that we could exploit to improve this photosynthetic trait. And so my colleague Lisa Ainsworth, in the USDA group here in Urbana-Champaign, is part of the RIPE project looking at those possibilities.
Helping nudge natural selection along, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I want to, Stephen Long, I want to thank you so much for sharing your research and congratulations on 10 years of the RIPE project. And I guess on behalf of humankind, best of luck as you continue your work.
Thank you.
Professor Stephen Long is the Eikenberry Endowed University Chair of Crop Sciences and Plant Biology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And as I mentioned, he is the director of a project called Realizing Increased Photosynthetic Efficiency, or RIPE. It was featured in a piece in The New Yorker last month. The piece is called Making a Better Plant. We will have a link to it at our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. Finally today, we are saying goodbye and best wishes to a member of our team. Ryan Wild has produced hundreds of segments in the past couple years, from conversations with Olympic athletes to travel ideas and interviews with public officials. He has a real knack for quickly filling, shall we say, unexpected vacancies on our calendar, and he was always pushing to get more of you, more callers, on air. Ryan is moving back to New York, where he'll be closer to family and working with WNYC's flagship daily program, which is called The Brian Lehrer Show. Not really sure what to make of the fact that he's leaving us for another Brian, but all kidding aside, Ryan, it's been great working with you. We'll miss you. Best of luck with what's next. And that's it for our show today. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.